Thank you, Jason, and we'll turn directly to Peter Orszag.
Thank you very much. I will try to be a bit brief, and maybe I'll even make up for Jason's 1 or 2 minute overrun. And I'm just going to make 4 basic points, the first of which anyone who has heard me speak on this topic over the last year and a half will have already heard, but just to start there, it is clear to me, and I think it's clear to anyone who's actually looked at the numbers, that the rate at which healthcare costs grow is the key to our fiscal future. And I think, again, just to underscore the point, we have largely misdiagnosed the nation's long-term fiscal problem by overestimating or over-exaggerating the role of demographics and underemphasizing the role of increasing costs for beneficiary. Most of the projected growth in Medicare and Medicaid costs does not come from the fact that there will be more beneficiaries and they will be older beneficiaries in the future. Most of the projected growth in Medicare and Medicaid comes from higher costs per beneficiary in the future. And until we get that basic fact in our head, we are going to be misallocating our analytical resources in terms of trying to tackle the underlying problem. There has been some continuing debate among some analysts with regard to the underlying analytics on that point. CBO will be coming out with an issue brief showing that regardless of how you do the calculation, you can do it this, that, and other way, the majority of the cost growth comes from higher cost per beneficiary. Embedded in that fact, though, I do think is a very substantial opportunity, which, again, I have spoken of before, which involves the opportunity to reduce healthcare costs without impairing health outcomes. I think this is perhaps the single biggest opportunity we have to improve economic efficiency in the United States. I formed a panel of health advisors at CBO and asked them what share of healthcare services delivered in the United States did they believe did not improve health outcomes regardless of the political economy difficulty of addressing the issue. And the answers range from 5 to 50%, with the modal answer being 30%. 30% of 16% of GDP is 5% of GDP, and healthcare services delivered. This is not profits or, you know, other things that people talk about. This is actual MRIs and surgeries and hospitalizations that do not improve health outcomes. 30% of 16% of GDP is 5% of GDP, or $700 billion a year. As an economist who has sort of played in many different worlds in policy settings, there is not another area, regardless of whether you're talking about marginal tax rates or impediments to international trade or what have you, all the things that economists tend to spend most of their time on, that comes remotely close to 5% of GDP. So there is a very substantial opportunity here. And what about capturing it? I heard a little bit of discussion about the political economy of reform. Let me put forward, before getting to some of the pathways to trying to bend that curve, a hypothesis that most of the motivation for addressing our long-term fiscal problems has been framed exactly as that, that we need to address the problem now so that our kids and grandkids and their kids and grandkids are better off. And from what I can observe, that doesn't seem to be generating much action. It strikes me that our political system simply does not deal well with gradual long-term problems. And the fact of the matter is, this is a gradual long-term problem. But it also has things that are happening today that it may be more immediately salient. And it strikes me that trying to capture those immediately salient and immediately implementable things, or immediate things that would have immediacy, may be better from a political economy perspective, while also having the great benefit, from my perspective, of helping to address the nation's long-term fiscal problem. So, for example, if you look in the last 6 months of life at UCA Medical, Medicare beneficiaries last 6 months of life, average cost at UCA Medical is $50,000 a year. At the Mayo Clinic, it's $26,000 a year. All of you, and there's no quality difference, if anything, the imperfect quality indicators that we have suggest the Mayo Clinic does better. All of you in this room who are American taxpayers are paying for that difference today, and you have absolutely no idea what you're getting in exchange for it. And that's not about your kids or grandkids, that's about your tax dollars today. Perhaps more important, and this is something that I think has not received enough attention, I think a key factor that perpetuates inefficiency in the health system is that most of us don't realize how much our employer-sponsored insurance is costing us. We focus on out-of-pocket expenses and sort of direct costs, but all of the evidence and all of the economic theory suggests that ultimately we all pay in the form of reduced take-home pay for the employer-sponsored insurance, the part that the employer, quote, pays, and yet we don't sort of focus on that, and that leads to less demand for efficiency in the health system today than would otherwise be the case. I was speaking at a Brookings conference on a similar topic, and I was amused that two leading health economists discussed this question. The first one said that he had spent about a half an hour on the Harvard intranet trying to find out how much Harvard contributed for his health plan, could not find the information that he thought was relevant, and then realized he wasn't covered by Harvard's plan because he was on his spouse's plan. The second illustrious, and these are actually quite serious people, the second Harvard economist then said, don't you realize that Harvard's been providing that information on paper pay stubs in a sort of box for some period of time? At which point, a Harvard law professor who is also cognizant and knowledgeable about economic matters came up and said, don't you realize that Harvard discontinued paper pay stubs several years ago? At the end of this discussion, which consumed the entire break during the Brookings conference, I was still confused about what information Harvard did or did not provide, let alone, and more importantly, how much the contribution actually was. And I think there's an important point there. The backlash that we hear about out-of-pocket spending, which is significant, is striking when you realize that out-of-pocket spending is only 15% of the total. If workers realized how much they were actually giving up today, your take-home pay today is being reduced by $10,000 for a family plan or whatever the number is, and that number could be significantly lower if we could capture these efficiencies, it strikes me that that would lead to much more demand and much more political economy push for capturing this potential opportunity than arguments that may strike some as abstract about our long-term future. Okay, so what about what are the pathways to actually capturing these potential opportunities? I think there are three things that are key regardless of the structure with which you pursue them. We need far more information about what works and what doesn't in our healthcare system because too much of the healthcare delivered in the United States is not backed by specific evidence that it works any better than anything else. We need to change our financial incentives so that we have incentives for better care rather than more care. And we have to pay way more attention to psychology and behavioral economics and things like defaults than just simply sort of the Econ 101 rational optimizing model would suggest. And on that, I would actually point out one danger. Taxes are very important, and I'll come to that in a moment. But one danger in looking to the tax code as the end-all, be-all for healthcare reform is that it perpetuates, I think, the myth that financial incentives are all that matters in driving behavior, both on the provider side and the consumer side. Financial incentives do matter, especially on the provider side. But if we want to be talking about driving behavior for especially beneficiaries, I would be much more, I'll give you a specific example, rather than worrying about a tax incentive being 10% or 15% or 20%, I would be much more inclined to look to what the default was for how people were funneled into different plans, rather than whether we were tweaking the match rate or the incentive rate by 5 or 10 percentage points, which is the traditional way of examining what drives behavior. Another way of putting this is I think we need a little less Econ 101, the simplistic version of the optimizing model in public policy, and a little bit more, I don't know whether it's psychology 101 or behavioral economics 101, but in terms of actually studying what drives human behavior, I think we are increasingly learning that things like salience and simplicity and ease and defaults can matter a lot more, at least on the beneficiary side, than financial incentives. I can be happy to take questions about other aspects of pathways to capturing these opportunities, but let me just close by saying very briefly what CBO is doing. We have been significantly expanding our healthcare staff. Last year at about this time, we had 30 full-time equivalents working on healthcare. We now have 47. We also have our first Robert Wood Johnson fellow who is sitting in the audience. We are putting together two significant volumes that will be out at towards the end of this year or perhaps very early next year, in which we are going through all of the things that are under discussion in the policy arena, care coordination, disease management, health information technology, and so forth, so on and so forth. And we will provide CBO's view on what the literature says and in some cases what the quantitative budgetary impact will be, so that no one will be surprised by our views on these major topics as you and others try to put together broad-reaching proposals. I'd also note, and appropriately given the focus on taxes, that we are spending a lot of time in collaboration with the Joint Committee on Taxation. Many proposals involve both tax and spending sides, and the coordination between the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is responsible for estimating the effects of changes on the revenue side, and CBO, which is responsible for combining those estimates with estimates on the spending side, is critically important to make sure that the underlying behavioral assumptions and are basically internally consistent between the two agencies. So there is now a lot more collaboration going on between the two agencies. Let me just close by saying, in looking forward, and I'm doing this mostly as a manager, trying to figure out where our staff should be aligned to meet the potential needs of the Congress in 2009. It strikes me that there are at least four major issues on the economic policy front, and obviously there are other questions that the Congress and the policy world may be addressing in 2009. And frankly, I don't know how they will be sequenced. If the economy is still weak, and I'm not saying that it will be, but if it is, there will likely still be significant discussion about macroeconomic stimulus and housing options and what have you. And frankly, the urgency of that, or at least the perceived urgency of that, may well drive out anything else on the economic policy front. As many people in the, or probably all people in the room know, there's also something that has to happen on the tax front, or something that will likely happen on the tax front, at the very least with regard to the estate tax, if not with regard to all of the expiring provisions of the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation. There's substantial and bipartisan interest in climate change legislation. And then there is the topic that is the subject of today's forum, healthcare, both on coverage and cost. I'm not licensed to practice politics, but it strikes me that there's no way that the political system in 2009 could handle all four of those topics. So some combination of congressional leadership and a new administration will have to figure out how they and perhaps other topics are sequenced, and it's not at all clear to me how that will turn out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, both Jason and Peter. And Peter, I want to toss the first question to you. You have described, perhaps quite appropriately, a much bigger job for the Congressional Budget Office than certainly even the CBO played in the early 1990s. And we know that the way the CBO came out and scored the Clinton plan, dealt that plan a perhaps not the fatal blow, but one of the many fatal blows was dealt to that plan by CBO. But what you're describing is a much even bigger job, because you just laid out a plan where CBO is going to be having to think about behavioral effects of tax incentives or other measures. And of course, anytime there is a health reform package, there will be many other measures. And you also, or I should say not necessarily you, but others have pointed out that it's probably time for CBO to start incorporating some health effects into its analyses of these proposals, which it has never done. So how is CBO going to do all of this? Are you going to panel a bunch of shrinks to start giving you some advice on what the feedback effects might be? How realistically, you've listed some measures about how you're going to approach this in terms of expanding the staff, but realistically, how are you going to incorporate all this analysis into a reasonable scoring set of opinions coming out of CBO?
Well, one step obviously is to somewhat expand our staff, because frankly, I think we fight very well for our weight, but there's so much that needs to be done that I think simply adding to the already quite exceptional staff was necessary. At the same time, I still need to make sure that people can sleep, so there are limits to what CBO can do. I would say in terms of health outcomes, the sort of health effects, that is one area where, at least with regard to the cost estimates, which are intended to serve a different purpose, it's not likely that in the very near term you're going to have a lot of information coming out of CBO about what the impact on health outcomes would be, in part because the research often is not there, and in part because the cost estimation process is designed for a specific purpose, and our papers and studies are a different matter, but the cost estimates themselves. Now, with regard to behavioral effects, I just think it's unavoidable. I mean, if you have anything from Part D to plans that are based, that move away from the employer-sponsored insurance system, or even that tinker with that, thinking about, for example, the most obvious category is default, thinking about what the default is for people is absolutely essential to a reasonable cost estimate. So it's not...
Spin that out a bit more. What do you really mean?
So, for example, in Part D, if under the low-income subsidy people were defaulted into the lowest cost plan, that would have spending implications. If in the Wyden Bennett plan there were no defaults in terms of what happens to people who don't decide, this is a key thing, makes all the difference in the world. We know in study after study after study, whether it's about individual accounts or about the fact that most people don't change their health plans even during the open season periods, that inertia is an incredibly powerful force in human behavior, more powerful, I would say, in most cases than direct financial incentives. And ignoring that is simply not an option. If we're ignoring it, we're saying it doesn't matter, and I think the evidence is now overwhelming that it matters a lot. And that's just one example, but I guess I'd say this is not simply a choice. I think it's a necessity that we do more of this. I'd also point out it is true we are trying to, I mean, these two volumes that we're putting together are a massive internal effort. And that comes out of, I would say, and I'll be, people in the room may not be surprised by this, I'll be blunt. That comes out of a bit of a frustration that in my former world and frankly in rooms like this, there have simply not been enough specific options put forward for policymakers. It may turn out that policymakers don't want to deal with cost growth. I don't know. But right now they don't have, at least from a systemic effect, system-wide effect, they don't have a list of 20 options that credibly would help. There may be two or three or four. There's not a long enough list. Another way of putting the same point is I have not seen, and if anyone in the room has one, please come forward and share it with me. I have not seen a single credible plan that would restore long-term balance to Medicare and Medicaid. And frankly, that's an analytical failing on all of our parts. So CBO is stepping up in part out of frustration, at least on my part, that we haven't been providing policymakers with enough options from which they can choose. And if there were more, then we could perhaps get by with doing less.
Well, here's one. Put all Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life on buses and take them to the Mayo Clinic. Let me ask Gene Sturley of Urban Institute, who, as I said earlier, also has an article in this issue about health and budget reform as handmaidens, to offer us a comment, Gene, particularly on your observation that we not only are we going to run the risk of not dealing with these questions that Jason and Peter have laid out, but also that we will probably run this risk of focusing on benefits at the risk of shifting the costs freely to other parties to pay for them.
Thank you, Susan. I'll try not to take too much time, mainly because I agree with 98% of what the panelists have said. In our article, we sort of proceed from a notion that's a little different than what I hear from a lot of health conferences. I go to a lot of health conferences where people say, well, you know, we know what to do in areas like Social Security, but in places like healthcare, we don't know what to do. And let me use a little metaphor. Let's suppose that we're parents and we're raising children, and the children are evolving all the time and their needs are constantly changing. We're debating whether we want to educate them, whether they need more playtime, how much TV they should watch. All these are legitimate debates, and they're going to constantly evolve and change. But let's suppose the kids are playing in the street while we're doing these debates. And we're saying, you know, well, we don't know what to do, so we just have to keep this current system in place. Well, I would say, well, we do know what to do. We know to bring them out of the street while we continue the debate. And I think that's sort of what we're suggesting in our article on budget reform and health reform being handmaidens. is that one has to set up processes, and I think that's partly what Peter's about in part in this attempt to list, come up with 20 options. We have to come up with processes that allow these decisions to be made within the normal budget constraints that we all face. Because, in fact, health reform does face a budget constraint, only it's indirect, and it's paid for indirectly by everything else we don't do. So I've done a lot of studies on what's happening to the children's budget, what's happening to the budget for community development. All these other budgets are going into a tailspin, and it's partly, for reasons outlined by our speakers, because we don't have in place processes that say there are limits on what we're going to do in health care unless Congress votes to increase and spend more there rather than someplace else, or unless individuals as workers, which Jason raised a lot, unless individuals as workers decide, I want to spend more there and less on getting wage increases. So just to summarize, give you one example of how that plays through and what these two gentlemen have talked about, is if you follow through closely Jason's notion on converting the health exclusion to a credit is a budget-constrained option. And you then, over time, vote for how much that credit increases. And so if you're voting for that over time, you all of a sudden have budget reform combined with health reform. Now, that's an example in the area of employee-provided health insurance and the exclusion. And I think what Peter's going to have to come up with is options like that, and we present some in our paper, in areas like Medicare. Let's have a Medicare system that's constrained within a budget, and if we want to do more, we have to vote somehow or another to vote for those increases. Those aren't easy, but I think we do know what to do. We know not to let the kid play in the street.
Thank you, Gene. Let me open this up to questions and discussion among members of the audience here. And once again, please identify yourself by name and affiliation.
Sharon Canner with the College of Health Information Management Executives. I want to pick up on something that Peter talked about, pathways and opportunities. And one of those is more information on what works. And you hinted at it, and obviously this gets to health information technology. Give you one example. Several years ago, there were a high number of deaths among people taking Vioxx, and Kaiser was tracking this within its system, and it soon figured out there were heart ailments and deaths associated with this, but it was the tracking, the health information, that is technology that is a very, very important tool. And that tracks with quality, and quality eventually saves, you improve quality of care, you save money in the long term. And what I would submit to you is that CBO, which is in a position of scoring the various health information technology pieces of legislation, and in the past there has been a lack of saying that HIT will save money over time. So I would just turn it around and urge you to look very carefully at the potentials. Right now there's the electronic health prescribing bill, provisions of which are now being teamed up with Medicare reimbursement for physicians. So just a plea to look at that real carefully.
Sure. Let me comment about health information technology specifically. Without a change in incentives and without a change in how the information is used, the structure in which just plop in a HIT system into a fragmented system without incentives for better care rather than more care is unlikely to be the panacea that many advocates hope for. Someone likened it to, we're wondering why the toast isn't coming out of the toaster. And some people say you have to plug the toaster in, and other people say you have to put the bread in a little hole, and other people say you have to press the button down. Of course, we have to do all of that. And so health information technology, the biggest return may be that if it were incorporated into a system with better incentives and with a better process of evaluating the information that's coming out of it, it can be a source of information for researchers, and then it can be a mechanism or a platform for pushing information and guidelines and whatever else back down to practitioners. But just by itself, I would not be expecting huge returns, and CBO actually, in the very near future, will be coming out with a quite extensive report specifically on health information technology and specifically examining some of the analyses that are floating around suggesting huge returns. Now, I would also differentiate health information technologies broadly from e-prescribing specifically. There may well be some modest cost savings from e-prescribing by itself.
Yes, a question here, and then we'll come back to the front.
I'm Karen Linscott with the LeapFrog Group, and what struck me about your presentations was, Jason, you seemed to be really talking a lot about access to care, like tax breaks that would encourage better access to care, where Peter, I think you were talking a lot more about the quality of the care that folks could get access to. Are there opportunities, Jason, to talk about, and you probably have in your article, which I haven't read yet, I'm sorry to say, about tax incentives to improve the quality of care. So, for example, tax breaks for hospitals that put in IT, tax breaks for or reductions if you choose a plan that has the highest quality providers in there. Could you talk about that connection a little bit?
Yeah, I just talk about, which I did very briefly in my comments there too, how some of the tax incentives affect the insurance that people buy. And I think it's through both this traditional economic 101 way of changing the price of insurance, and it's also, as Peter said and I discussed in the article, through behavioral mechanisms like just letting people know how much their insurance actually costs and how much they're paying for it through their employer and through themselves so they can make more informed choices. I think there's probably a lot more that one could do beyond those steps of creating a better set of incentives for people to purchase the right insurance policies. I think you'd have to ask whether you want those to be tax spent or spending programs at that point. It might be that those other things would be better constructed as directly subsidizing the activities that you want to happen. But it's not something I discuss.
And a question here.
Gary Christofferson, former Fed, current citizen. First, I'm going to reinforce, Peter, your point about HIT. My experience as CIO with Veterans Health is absolutely correct. It's the healthcare reform, not the IT. The IT is a great enabler, but only an enabler there. Let me go back to a point I think for both of you, which is, and Peter, you've emphasized it, we've talked about it before, the behavioral aspect. So little is understood by all the different parts of the healthcare system about how behavior comes into play and how we affect it, whether it's in tax policy, whether they're looking at providers, looking at people, what they do in their families, all those different groups. So my question, again, kind of goes back to more detail, which is how do we do what we know least, whether it's doctors trying to deal with people trying to change lifestyle or providers responding to financial incentives and you can take any other part of the population, how you use your tax credits, those kinds of things. How do we actually go the next step of building in the behavioral aspect and really understanding how it affects policies and programs?
I'll take a stab at that, and unfortunately it's not a very satisfying stab. In many areas, we simply don't know enough yet to give specific suggestions or guidance or options or what have you. And I guess my point is that needs to change. So we have stunning success in retirement saving with regard to opt-out 401ks. People in this room and the health field in general, I think, need to be searching much more actively for similar things that work. And I mean, there are now a compelling sort of rising set of suggestions that it may well work. I think most people want to lead healthy lives, and even small impediments to doing that lead to very large outcome differences. Similar, just the same logic as the retirement saving thing, that even a small impediment having to read through the binder and then sign up for the 401k leads to very large outcome differences. I think there is evidence with regard to both eating behavior, with regard to exercise, with regard to all of the things that influence health outcomes that kind of thing matters. So the study saying that you should go get a vaccine next Tuesday, very low implementation success. You should get a vaccine next Tuesday at this place. Yep, the rate significantly. You should get a vaccine next Tuesday at this place at 4 p.m. and perhaps even the appointment has already been made for you, which you can change if you want to. That flips the default in people's mind, and at that point, having the map and the specific time in their head, they're supposed to show up at 4 p.m. next Tuesday, and the vaccination rates go way up. We're too early to be able to kind of, give policy suggestions or what have you. My point is just we have been neglecting this aspect of human behavior to our peril, because I think this is far more powerful than the things we traditionally study.
Right. If I could add one, I think that also matters for insurance. So you look, if you look purely at financial incentives, you wouldn't understand why the take-up rate for employer-sponsored insurance, where you often have to pay a bunch yourself, is so much higher than the take-up rate for Medicaid. If you look at the behavioral, the stigma, the length of the forms, and even just the automatic decision process, when you go to work for an employer, you're locked in a room until you fill out the form one way or the other. No one does that same thing for Medicaid. You don't see that. And the reason I think that's important is if you want to talk about shifting to the individual market, you lose that automatic decision framework that you have with employer-sponsored insurance. So you lose any single day where you're locked in the room and have to fill out the form, or the personnel person, you know, will keep harassing you. And so the traditional concern with the individual market, where if you had chronic health conditions or you're poor, you couldn't get health insurance, I think this behavioral consideration that if you're in the individual market, you don't have anyone to sit down and make you fill out the form on a given day, even to say you don't want insurance, even to opt out of it, I think that could have a bigger effect on whether you get insurance or not through the individual market. So I think we need to think about this in the case of getting health insurance as well as what you get with your health insurance, which Peter was just describing.
What both of you are talking about is a level of prescriptiveness that is not commonly found in much federal legislation. It may be followed up on by regulations that would come out of HHS or others, but really you're talking about legislation that gets into a level of detail and prescriptiveness of what human behavior ought to be that may be tough for the public to take.
I'm not sure that that's right, and I'm not sure, I should clarify, I'm not sure that this is all policy stuff, but you know, the fact of the matter is someone, non-policymaker, but you know, someone running the cafeteria at your place of employment is deciding where the fruit is placed, either at the beginning of the line or at the end of the line. That shouldn't be a federal policymaker, but someone is making that decision. And the evidence strongly suggests that if the fruit's placed at the front of the line, fruit consumption is much higher than if it's at the end of the line. The point is, across a whole sphere of our endeavors, we have not paid enough attention to simple things like that that have very large and significant effects. Now, some things may be influenced by federal policy. I'm coming back to Part D. If we defaulted people into a particular kind of plan, that would have much different effects than, or even if we defaulted the people eligible for the low-income subsidy into particular plans, that would have much different effects than if we defaulted them into other plans or if there was no default at all. And so again, I would say in many cases, it's not like there are new decisions that have to be made. Making no decision is a decision itself.
Jason, you want to add to that?
And this is true in the 401k literature. I think there's an appeal to, and Sunstein and Thaler called it libertarian paternalism, policies that set a default and then let people opt out of it. So if you had automatic enrollment in health insurance, I think this needs to be studied more. I'm not sure exactly what I think about it. You wouldn't be saying everyone has to get insurance. You'd be saying everyone inattentive has to get insurance. And if you really don't want insurance, you can sign the form and get out of it. So I think there's a certain appeal to both sides and some of these types of letting people make decisions but shape how those decisions are made.
Well, the phrase libertarian paternalism is a perfect note to end on because it's sufficiently ambiguous and touching on all different points in a political year. So congratulations on bringing us to a topic we can really understand as we come to grips with politics and health reform, which we'll do in our next session. Thanks to both of you for a terrific